So hopefully this will be a more interesting way to see how this works and with actually an actual geometric construction. So you might recall that the following two theorems for metric calculus. So if I have a smooth function, then curl of grad f is 0. And similarly, if v is a smooth vector field, div curl and so you can prove these by, well, you can write out what this is in coordinates and write out what this is in coordinates and do the computation and get 0, or which is usually how it's proven, and there's more abstract ways to prove it. The more interesting fact is that there's a converse to this. So if curl v 0, then v is a conservative vector field, so it's the gradient of something. And similarly, if div v is 0, then v is curl of something. So it turns out this is true in considerably more generality, and this isn't. It's true in some generality, but not everyone. So let's consider, so for example, I'm going to consider the set U, which is R3 minus the z-axis. So I have, taken out this axis, and I'm allowing everything else. So this has an issue where I can sort of wind around the z-axis, and that loop, it's not the same in some sense as this, because what it contains is a whole. So this is the kind of thing that topology is set up to measure, but we can do this actually precisely with calculus. So I have a vector field called theta, which is given by y over x squared plus y squared, x over x squared plus y squared, 0. And so this is some vector field on U. And let's take its curl. So if you calculate out, you get I, J, K, X, Y, Z, negative Y over star. So if we calculate what this is, so for I, we get derivative of this, which is 0, derivative of this with respect to Z is 0. So I times 0 plus J times the derivative of this, which is 0, derivative of this with respect to z, which is 0, plus k times x derivative of this minus y derivative of that. And so you can see by symmetry, the x derivative of this is exactly the y derivative of minus the y derivative of that. So they're going to cancel out. So this is 0. So we would expect that this is the gradient of something. Now, there's a thing called the fundamental theorem of calculus for line integrals, which says if v is the gradient of something, then the integral around any loop is 0. So, however, if we look at, let's integrate this thing around the around the unit circle. So S1 here denotes the unit circle in the xy plane. So I'm doing this exactly like this way. And now x squared and y squared are 1. So if we integrate this, what we're going to get is just 2π, the arc length of this circle. So therefore, it can't be a gradient of something. And so this thing is not true in general. So we might take this as an opportunity to set. This is very pretty theorem, but it's no longer true. But it's also very, so this is the seed from which Durand cohomology is built. And it, because because understanding what kinds of things cause theorem 2 to fail in some sort of, in some suitable, more general setting can actually be a very powerful way of understanding. So what it tells us is that this whole, this removing this z-axis does something different, that this space has a different kind of calculus than R3, and therefore also a different kind of topology. So next question is, how many things violate theorem 2? Like, I have this, you know, what, are there others? And I mean, sure, I could stick, like, you know, 17 in front of it. I could stick any number I want in front of this. There's infinitely many, which is, so that maybe not the right question. A better question might be, you know, if these form a vector space, which they don't quite, because zero doesn't violate it. But if I had something like that, what dimension would it be? And that's a problem, because if I take d theta plus the gradient of something which does work, then I still get something which doesn't work. Because the gradient term vanishes when I do this, and the gradient term vanishes when I take the curl. So the space of problems, in some sense, is huge. But the fact we are able to do something interesting with is if I have two things which causes two things which violate theorem 2, so I have d theta 1 and d theta 2, their difference is always the gradient of a function. So we'll actually be able to see this later. Oh wait, no, not for this. So in this sense, there's only one kind of thing. There's really only one problem, or there's really only one whole, or a couple ways of thinking about that. So what we're going to do for the next however long is actually make this precise. So the first thing you should do in any of this story is provide a setting. You know, maybe your favorite book doesn't explicitly open by talking about it as a dark and stormy night or whatever, but it's still going to provide you with the details that show you where you are and what's going on. So the setting for this story is going to be manifolds. Now, to define a manifold precisely requires, you have to say a lot of things about like topological space and second countability and whatnot, and I don't want to do that because that will distract us from the point of the calculus and how this is accessible from this perspective. So I'll give you an idea of what's going on, which is not that far from the actual idea, and then you can go look up the rest of the book. So what is a manifold? Well, we're going to, in this context, a manifold is a place where you can do calculus. So there's an important distinction here. It's not a place I can do calculus. I'm terrible at computing things. But you or maybe one theoretically can do calculus. And so we'd like to make this, we'd like to say, well, what does that mean? So the model is Rn, where I have some coordinate system, x1 through xn. And I can do calculus in the normal way. I can take derivatives with respect to any of these things. I can take gradients, directional derivatives, even divergence, all that. So the first thing we can do immediately is, let's say I have some open set inside Rn. So just like this. So this thing is called U, because open sets are always called U. So I can do calculus just as well on that. If I have a smooth function on this open set, I can take its derivative on this open set, I can integrate it on this open set, and I still have one system of coordinates. So one way that shows up is in polar coordinates. So polar coordinates work everywhere except zero. And so I'd like to be able to conceptualize polar coordinates as a way of like doing calculus in polar coordinates as fitting into this paradigm. So the first thing is, let's give a coordinate system R of theta, where R is positive, and theta is between 0 and 2 pi exclusive. That gets us an open neighborhood, which makes it easier to talk about things like smooth functions. So what we're doing is we're missing out on this thing. And the thing that I'm missing should be infinitely thin, but chalk is not infinitely thin. But now I have everything else. So this is an open subset of Rn, or well, R2, which is great. But now I've put a different coordinate system on. I have this, and I have x1. So the first generalization bunch of different coordinate systems. So I could put some other kinds of coordinates on this if I really wanted to, but these are the kinds that you usually see. In R3, you might see on, you know, if you subtract the origin and the x-axis, you might get something like cylindrical, spherical, and rectangular coordinates. And so this, so now that we have multiple systems of coordinates, well, what does it mean that we can do calculus? I want the calculus in this system to be the same as the calculus in that system. And, well, we had that formula, where if I want to integrate, you know, f of y, oops, dx dy, I'm a bad calculator, rdr dk. So this represents, if I'm passing from these coordinates to these coordinates, I need to change my calculus, essentially, by this parameter. But that's invertible, since we're not at the origin. I can go back and forth. And anything I can do in this setting, I can do in this setting, especially talking about whether something is differentiable or integrable. So I have, even though I have two different ways of looking at it, two different languages for talking about this, the end result is the same. And so this is known as a local coordinate system. Which just means on an open set we have a bunch of coordinates. Is everyone on board so far? Are there any questions?
So the polar coordinates example, your problem with that axis is because why?
So
because of the theta parameter, because it only.
So we don't want multiple defined.
How do you define, given a set of your parameters, how do you find the causes problem?
So the issue with polar coordinates is what I want is for one point here to correspond to one point on the r theta axis.
Right. Okay, so like what if it were, you're talking about a circle with a single line going through it,
mm-hmm.
but if you were like Pac-Man shaped where the line was like wider.
Yeah, that would be fine.
That would be kind of the same example, but because it's homomorphic to closing that gap,
mm-hmm.
the calculus doesn't change between the two circles.
Yes.
Like the one graph.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like Rn, because Rn doesn't have anything like that. It's completely, it's completely like, you know, hole free.
Yeah.
Every open set is a set.
So right now, this is still the same as Rn, because this hole goes, like, the way we have topologist intuition is that this hole goes off to infinity, so it's not really a hole. I can, like, push this away. In the same way that this is the same set as that. So the issue is just I don't want my values to overlap. Like if I allow values here, then in open set I'd have like zero to like, you know, 2 pi plus epsilon for some small epsilon, maybe like pi over 16. And in that case, if I have a value right here, it pulls back to two different values here. And that's so, you know, that's not that bad, because it's still like a reasonably nice parameterization. But it makes it a lot harder to reason about things, because I want to describe things like a function here by pulling it back here and then talking about it. And if I have more than one thing going on, it gets a little more confusing.
Okay.
It's easier to have multiple coordinate systems than multiple, like than one that covers that wraps around. Does that help?
So when you're defining that epsilon, you're allowing your space to kind of contract into that.
Why don't you just try drawing like the sheet in two things? Because I think he's just confused about like what makes a patch good. And if you draw it on just like a generic, like, you know, like the rubber sheet kind of picture.
Well, I'm more concerned about like the.
So like what I don't want to do is I don't want to have this issue where, you know, Pac-Man is like fit in itself. Because then in this overlap, it's not one to one. We'd like it to be one to one onto this image. Or homeomorphic. If that's answering your question. Okay. Take your time.
You can get the other chart.
Okay. Yeah, so one thing that might help is where we're going after this, which is I want to, instead of just doing, like, so that it's bad that we're missing the x-axis. But the x-axis is a nice friendly place. So we'd like to get most of it back, except the origin. Because, like, whatever we do in polar coordinates, we have, like, because we need r to be And there's a way to extend this over the origin, but that'll require more chunks. Or local coordinate systems is the same thing as trunk. So I'm going to define another chunk, coordinate system on this, which is r phi, where phi goes from 0 to 2i, and we say phi is equal to pi minus theta over pi plus theta. I don't know if it will work. So now I have a different parameterization of a different set. I have some local coordinate system here, and I have some local coordinate system here. But if I want to switch, suppose I'm at a point which is in both of them. So I want to be able to switch between them. And that's perfectly okay, because it's just like a linear transformation. So in this way, I can say, let's consider the union of these two sets, which is everything except the x-axis. And when I do that, every point is in some coordinate system. And if it's in two different coordinate systems, then the change of coordinates map is smooth. So calculus here in this coordinate system is the same as calculus in this coordinate system. So in this way, I've defined three coordinates, r theta, x, y, and r phi, on r2 minus the origin. So not that thing, but everything else. And in doing so, I've given us the ability to do calculus on this thing. Now, you could have just done that for x, y, and said, okay, well, x, y not equal to 0. But this example will motivate the more abstract definition. So the key is two parts.
Every point is in some local coordinate system. The coordinate change maps, or change of coordinates maps, or transformations, or whatever. So they respect the structure of calculus.
And what that means is, any notion in calculus that I have on one, if I can be described in two coordinate systems, then calculus here is the same as calculus here. You know, there may be factors like the Jacobian, but it's okay because in terms of things being differentiable or integrable, that doesn't change. And notions like area or whatnot transform, but in the end we get the same value. So what we can do is we can use this to define an abstract manifold. And this is the part where I'm going to wave my hands a little bit, but a manifold is a space, and what kind of space, that depends what you're doing, and what topological assumptions you want to make, which satisfies those two conditions. So in this case, we've realized this is a manifold in a different way than usual. And are they the same? Yes, and you can show that, but that's not super relevant to what we're doing.
The calculus in this space will allow you to kind of divide by 0 on the point, because there's not there isn't a 0 anymore. Now your division ring is...
There's no...
So you take out the origin, and so every point as you approach the origin gets closer and closer, but
sure.
Doesn't have, it should reach 0, but it doesn't have it in this space.
Well, sure. That's because this is an open set. So in the same way, as we get bigger and bigger, we can think of this as like getting closer to infinity. And if we thought of Rn inside the sphere Sn plus 1, then that's actually really happening. Just like, I can think of two of the units here, S1. And all of this is a copy of R, but this is some point at infinity. So I can say, oh, we're getting closer and closer to infinity, but this perspective, that doesn't make any sense, because infinity is just always very far away. And so this structure doesn't actually care too much about distance. So because zero doesn't exist, then getting closer and closer to zero doesn't actually do anything for us, because we're never going to get there. And from the perspective of, like, a point set topology, you know, if I take a sequence of points just gets closer to zero, it doesn't converge because zero's not there.
Yeah.
But it's the same as if I took a sequence of points going off to infinity. You know, sure, there might be some infinity out there somewhere in some model of your space, but it's not here for the purpose of looking at this.
But where, if it's still like a calculus compatible structure, mm-hmm. that means that the identity has to be in there somewhere. Where did it go?
The identity?
Like the origin.
So calculus is not an algebraic thing. Like,
oh.
As much
oh,
as
so,
I w-
oh, you can have a free point because of the local coordinate system. So
yes.
It doesn't really matter how you set the system up. You can transform it.
Mm-hmm. Because, like, I could also do this, and I could say, okay, well, let's do everything except the point 3, 4. Like, I don't like that point, so I'm going to take everything except it. And so we're not using the vector space structure of R at all. We're just using the geometric structure, which allows us to add things. And, you know, but we're not worrying about scale and multiplication. Like, we can do it, but it's not, like, we're not dealing with, like, the fact that zero is missing isn't a problem because we're not doing algebra. Now, doing algebra is great. And we'll get to algebra eventually, but when we do that, we'll have the origin. Does that address what you were worried about? Okay. Any other concerns, side remarks, jokes? Oh, you never know what's happened. Okay. So manifold. So a couple examples are n-dimensional space, where you just take the usual coordinate chart. Great. That is a manifold because there's just one and it's kind of vague for a symbol. I can also take the unit sphere, which is known as Sn inside Rn plus 1. And so I can give that charts in two different ways. So the first is, as a subset of this, it just gets coordinates from x1 to xn plus 1. But I can also give it two charts, one which looks like this. And so I can think of this as like negative 1, comma 1, where I just wrap the interval around like this, and another one where I wrap the interval around like that. So in this case, you might say, well, why are we doing this abstraction when we can just do everything, we can just put everything inside some space and use those coordinates? And the answer is, it's nicer to do it intrinsically. So fact, which is not at all obvious from where we are right now, a set of lines in R2 is a manifold. Because, you know, if you have a bunch of lines, you can talk about, you know, what it means to be near another line, and this, you know, you can write down some coordinate charts. But it's much easier to do this than to say explicitly lines are some subset of some high dimensional vector space. So another example of a manifold is the open set U that we had that was a problem, because it's an open subset of Rn. So we can just give it the usual charts as a subset of Rn. Or we can consider the polar coordinate charts that we use, but throw in a z so we get cylindrical and rectangular coordinates. And these give us a coordinate system for that that space. And so we can actually call it a manifold. Is that good for everyone? Okay. So the next thing we need to do is talk about like, we want to generalize functions and vector fields. So to do that, we're going to have to talk about something called differential forms. And again, there's, you know, this can be stated in a little more generality, and I'm going to wave my hands a little bit. But what I'd like to show is these things generalize due to Ryan curl. Because, for example, a manifold may not be three-dimensional, so curl makes absolutely no sense in general. So a differential form is something we can do calculus to. And well, so let's start by, well, we'd like to integrate them because, we can usually integrate things a little more easily than we can differentiate them, because there's more things we can integrate. So what things can we integrate? If I want R3, then I have dx, dx1, dx2, dx3. And as, you know, generations of calculus students have asked, what exactly are these? And the answer answer is don't worry about that right now because it's really subtle. But one way I can think about dx1 is I have this vector field, which is just going flowing in the x direction, which is in this case north. So if I have some curve going through here, then I can take a line integral, so this is my curve gamma, of some function. And that's just taking, you know, the dot product with this thing. So this is a good model for thinking about what dx1 actually is when I say I'm integrating with respect to some coordinates. So in the same way, I could take dx1, dx2, and integrate for a surface integral. And for doing just, you know, things in the plane, like plain old integrals with Fubini's theorem, I would have that this is true. But because we're doing things with surfaces, so we need to keep track of orientation. So what direction is left and what direction is right? It's like if I have a loop and I integrate.
No.
Okay. So if I integrate around this way, I might get positive 1. But if I integrate around this way, I might get negative 1. So we need to keep track of what that is. I mean, this is not true. So this is important because this is like, you know, this is a thing that confused me. Instead, so we're not going to write it like this because that, so it's written like this. And this is because it's obtained from something called a wedge product. But it helps me remember we're not just doing Fubini theorem, you know, product measure stuff. We're doing differential forms and a alternate. So in the same way, if I'm in Rn, I can define something like dx1, dx2, dxk. And if I switch two of these, then the sign flips. So as an immediate corollary, if I have dxj, wedge dxj, well, if I switch these two, then the sign flips. So this is equal to its inverse. So it has to be zero. So a differential form, like more algebraically, we can think of these as a bunch of things that look like, you know, a sum like, you know, dx1, dx2, plus dx3, dx2, plus blah, blah, blah. And so we're always going to require them to have the same dimension, which is the number of things I wedge together. So this is called a two-form because there's two of them. So these are things which we can use to integrate. But I said things that can be integrated. So now I'm going to take some functions. So f of x1, x2, x3. Dx1 plus g of sum dx2. So this is what a differential form looks like in generality, is functions times these basic differential forms. And so the rule here, so this is honestly something that can be integrated, because, well, if I have a loop, then this just becomes a line integral. And similarly for, you know, surface integrals and volume integrals and all that jazz. So is everything making more or less sense so far? Cool. Bombard me with questions if you have them. So formally, so we've got functions times things like this. So what does this mean on a manifold? Because here, coordinates are not, we don't just have a bunch of coordinates, we have a bunch of coordinates in different places. So here's where I'm going to be just a little bit vague, but the idea is I want something which at every, so I want a bunch of things which look like this in every coordinate system, and, well, physicists would say it would transform smoothly, but the idea is that I just have something up here, some abstract differential form, such that when I look at it in every coordinate system, like different magnifying glasses or like peering around like this, I don't know, it looks exactly like this. So, something which is, you know, f of x1, xn. Hello. Yeah. heard the theorem that, like, if I have a cylinder with radius z and height a, then you know its volume is pi times z times z times a, right? Very useful, you know, geometry. Anyways, so a differential form on a manifold is something which looks like this in each coordinate system. So on a sphere, I might have like dx doesn't really make sense, like globally, but on the circle, I can certainly take d theta, which would be given by integrating along this line. And in fact, that's the d theta that we started with, which was the whole column and then jumpstarted this. So we can integrate different forms, but given their name, it suggests that we should be able to differentiate them too. And that is a thing called the exterior derivative, which is so this is a general way of differentiating differential k-forms. One thing I forgot is that so the space of these is the node of omega k, m, and it is a vector space. It's a huge vector space, but it's a vector space. So I want to define a differentiation operation, which takes the k and gives me a k plus 1 form. So the idea is that zero forms, well, so first of all, what is a zero form? A zero form is a function with zero of these. So it's just a function. So if I differentiate a function, I should get one form, which we've already seen sort of look like vector fields. And if I differentiate one form, I should get a two form, which has more directions that I can integrate against, and so forth. So this seems at least plausible. So I want to play this game as the following. So f in omega 0 m. So I'm going to do this in coordinates, which I know is, you know, physicist way of doing it rather than a mathematician's way, but it makes it a little easier to see. So let's say I have coordinates x0 or x1, xn. So in this case, df is I just take the derivatives times dxi. So in this, and you can already see this looks, if I consider this as a basis for, as a sort of basis for one forms, then what I get was, you know, df over dx1, df over dxn. And this should look familiar as the gradient. But again, we have to make that identification. So next, let's say I have a more general thing, which is f dx I1 wedge dx I2. So in this case, I just take df, and then I adjoin it to whatever I have. So what this means is I expand this out, and then if something appears twice, well, then we have zero. So that those terms die. So in this way, I added one term, so I really do get a k plus one form. So this may seem a little confusing, which is to say, when I saw it, it was absolutely confusing the first time. So maybe it helps to see an example. So x squared dy plus yz dz. So this is a good old one form on R3. And well, what do we get? So first we take this term. So x squared becomes 2x dx dy. And nothing else with respect to y and z. Y becomes z dz d wedge dy plus I can differentiate with respect to z. So y dz wedge dz. Now, this is zero, so it goes away. And this is our answer for what the derivative of this is. And so, since I have dx dy and dz dy, this is a two-fold. Okay. Did that example more or less make sense? Next. So another fact, which is important, but I'm not going to prove, is if I do this twice, I get zero. And so you can do this by looking at the definition and just like writing it out, but that's no fun, so I'm not going to do it. You're probably not going to do it either, but you could. And this is actually quite important. If you've seen homological algebra, you know where the story is going. And if you haven't, that's okay, because you might have noticed that sounds like the approach of graph. The intuition is something like the idea that if I have a surface or something, or a manifold with boundary, well, so like this is my thing. So I can take its boundary, which is this, but the boundary is zero. That is not the same as this, but they're related. So I just mentioned this, and I want this to imply theorem one. Well, okay. So we already saw that if I make the identification of this to this, where I say dxi is the ith component in a vector field, then the differential from zero, or from zero form to one form, is gradient. Cool. Now, I'm going to say, let's say I have a vector field V is Vx, Vx plus Vy, Vy plus Vz, Vz, which is the same thing as saying in coordinates, it's Vx, Vy. Right? So now let's differentiate it. So d of v as an operation from one forms to two forms will give us after some computation dz dy plus dy dz times dy dz dz plus plus, you know, if what I'll get is dvx dz minus dvz dx, dx wedge dz, plus dvx dy minus dvy dx, dx dy. So this is just permuting these three variables, one after the other. So I didn't want to write it all out. But the point is, if you do that, you get something which looks a lot like the curl. And in fact, so I need to make a different identification. Vector forms are not just one forms. They can also be identified with two forms. And the story of this, called Hodgstar, is interesting, and I wish I had time to go into it. But the point is, so if I identify dx, dy, dz with dx, dy, wedge dz, plus dy, dx, wedge dz, plus dz, dx, wedge dy, then, so this is the first term of the curl, and when I cycle with permute, I just get the second and third terms. So in this case, d from omega 1 to omega 2 is curl. Okay, so at this point, you're probably thinking the last one has to be divergence because that's all we have left. So if I regard vx, dy, dz as this two form, well then when I differentiate it, I get, so the only thing that's non-zero when I take this has to be with the derivative with respect to x. So I get dvx with respect to x times dx wedge dy wedge dz plus dvy over dy, because here the only thing that if I take with respect to x, then it dies because I had x twice. And same with z. So the only thing I have left is y. And dvz over z, exactly the same thing. And then each of these is times dx, wedge dy, wedge dz. So divergence is a function. So I need to make a different identification. Functions are zero forms, but also three forms. So this is equivalent to the function, dvx dx plus dy over dy plus dz over dz. So that means So now we're in the correct setting to like to actually generalize this question that we asked. And that is, when does this have a converse? If d omega equals 0, is omega equal to d alpha for some alpha? Before I go on, are there any questions about the calculations I sort of dragged you through, but not really, or anything else? Because again, the point is not the exact calculations, but does this intuition of how we got from differential forms to curl divergence and gradient, and why this is the right, you know, how this is the generalization of what we wanted to know about theorem two, is that all cool with everyone? All right. So this notation says that omega is closed, and this notation says that it's exact. So close. The question is every closed form exact? And that's just literally rewording. And so this is what, so now we're actually going to like talk about Dirac cohomology. So we're going to, instead of just talking about each one individually, we're going to talk about all of them together. So the first thing we can do is, so on some manifold, I can just string all the maps together. So I decided to give these different names, so I'm going to be talking about more than one of them in the same like, diagram. So this is a diagram where I can go, you know, I can travel amongst the arrows, but if I do it twice, then I end up with 0. This is called the Durand complex. There's an analogous story for like complex manifolds and complex cohomology, and it's not called a complex complex, but I think it should be. So we know that dk plus 1 composed of dk is 0. So in other words, the image of dk is a subset of the kernel of dk plus 1. If you've had linear algebra but not abstract algebra, this is often called the column space, and this is often called the null space, but they're the same thing. And this is fewer syllables. So we want to know, is this everything? What's missing? The difference in their sizes as vector spaces. And that is the Dirac cohomology. So the kth Dirac cohomology cohomology. I guess it's a group, but since it's a vector space, it's kind of weird to think about that. Is HKM, which is kernel of EK plus 1, where image of K equals so this is the thing. This is Dirac cohomology. And so what we really wanted, what we're asking for is what was the size of these solutions. It was really the dimension of this space. But if we have the data of the vector space itself, it's a little more powerful. So I don't know if all of you have seen quotient spaces, and if you haven't, you should think of this as the orthogonal complement to this within this. Because, as you know, for everything, like in general, that will be a space of the right dimension. But this is a little more intrinsic. Critically, we don't need the inner product to define. So the first thing you might ask is, well, we wanted a number, which was the size of the difference. Why do we have a whole vector space? And briefly, I'm just like, the idea is, let's say I have a map between manifolds, which is smooth. And smooth means infinitely differentiable, but I didn't tell you what differentiability means for maps of manifolds. It means in every coordinate chart, it's infinitely different. In every coordinate system, it is a smooth function on Rn. So if I have this smooth map, then a differential form can be thought of as a function on n. So if I have omega in big omega k, then I get something called pullback, which is functions, omega composed with f. And this is what this is, this is not a precise definition, but this is the idea that like functions, I can precompose with f and I get a function here. So this is great because this means that closed forms get sent to closed forms, exact forms get sent to exact forms. So now I have a map from hk of n to hk of m. And a theorem is that this map is linear. And so this is really the power in cohomology. It's like, okay, I assume vector space, whatever. Vector spaces are everything. You know, we might live in one. But this linear map tells us a lot of information. You can use it to calculate fixed points of maps if I go for n to itself. I can use it to determine whether n and m are the same or different. In some sense of sameness that I'm not going to talk a lot about right now. And it's also an invariant for maps. So I might want to know whether two rotations of the sphere are the same, in whether they preserve some sort of property that I like calculus. So it turns out if I rotate by an angle by like 5 pi, and I rotate by, say, pi over 2, they're not the same because they induce different maps here. And that means that for the purposes of what we're doing, for example, like if you want to calculate the number of times something winds around, which you can do with calculus, then you get a different number. And in that case, sure, okay, it winds around a bunch of times. You already knew that. But when you're doing this for high-dimensional spheres or objects that are harder to visualize, this is an extremely helpful tool for doing stuff. So is this does this definition make sense to make sense to everyone?
You can also point out, remember how you said with R2 minus the z-axis that you add gradient f and it still gave you something that wasn't good, so you're kind of getting rid of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, oh, that's a good point. So the reason we're making this quotient is back when we were looking at u, we had, so I had, say, d theta 1 and d theta 2, which were both, so if these were both things which did not satisfy theorem 2 or did not have a converse to this, well, so what does that mean? That means that these both define non-zero classes in Durand cohomology. But the fact is, since these are one forms, we care about each one of these. So this is a one-dimensional vector space, and this is a thing which we're not going to show right now because it'll take a bunch of monkeying around with, honestly, not super interesting calculus and geometry. But this is a one-dimensional vector space. So what that means is, theta 1 equals lambda d theta 2 inside cohomology, which means as forms, this is true plus some exact form. And that's what I was telling you earlier, is any two forms differ by an exact form, which is really the statement that this is one-dimensional. And that's a more precise way of saying it. And it's a much more finite, this is, you know, finite dimensional in a lot of cases. And so actually for manifolds, I think it's always finite dimensional, which is the only place this makes sense. Oops. So great. This is really nice. Finally, before in the last moments of this talk, I'd like to just quickly write down this for R3, because it'd be a shame if we don't calculate anything. So what happens if k is greater than 3? In this case, we have forms of the form dx I 1, dx I 2, dx I 3, dx I 4. So by the pigeonhole principle, if I drill lots of holes in few pigeons, at least one pigeon has more than one hole in it. So one of these must be d. So it has to be equal to 0. So if k is greater than 3, hk of R3 0. So what about k less than 3? So now let's use the Durand complex. So we already calculated what these maps are. This one is gradient. This one is curl. And this one is divergence. So H0. So first of all, let's look at, so we, by theorem 2, the comp, actually, so by these theorems, this sequence is exact. The image at one thing is the kernel of the other. And so that means that if I start here, the image of this is exactly the kernel of that. Because if something is a gradient of something else, if and only if its curl vanishes. So that means that H1 is zero. Because these are exactly the same, so I get a zero-dimensional vector space. In orthogonal complement words, the orthogonal complement to the entire thing is just zero. Exactly the same thing happens here. Divergence vanishes if and only if it's curl of something. So, zero. So this is also zero, and that's a little weirder. But the idea is that we're continuing off into something higher. So the kernel is everything, and the image is also everything because you can look at think everything is a divergence of the antiderivative, more or less, and the more or less is enough to get us this. So the thing which is interesting is H zero. So the image is nothing because D negative one is we don't know what it is because this is zero, so this has to be zero. So what makes a gradient vanish? So if delta f is, or not delta, if del f is zero, then we know f has to be a constant. So we get a one-dimensional vector space of constant functions. So this is the calculation of the Jerome homology of R3. And this is the starting point from which everything else comes. This is a small step in a big world. And so if you want to learn more about this, two amazing textbooks are Botentu's Differential Forms in Algebraic Topology, or Madsen and Tornehov's From Calculus to Cohomology, which are both at a higher level than this one, but take this and run with it. So I think this is all that I meant to say. Are there any questions or things that I said wrong or confusing?
I think your definition
it's off by a different index, might know. Okay. Thank you. You're right.
And so no one has any questions?